It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in Wisconsin Life, we check out the local origins of the snowmobile.
First, how many times do you eat out every week? If you're like most Americans, the average is about 5.
Nutrition experts say this could affect your health, especially if you don't know which menu options support good health and which ones undermine it.
With us now is Hope Warshaw. She's a dietitian and nutrition educator who specializes in diabetes management, healthy restaurant eating, and weight management. She's the author of Eat Out, Eat Well. Hope, welcome to Central Time.
Delighted to be here.
So when it comes to, you know, American populace, it's eating out 5 times a week. Some people probably a lot more than that. What can go wrong with healthy eating goals?
What can go wrong is that restaurant meals, and this is research that shows this, are typically higher in fat, which leads to them being higher in calories, typically higher in sodium, and typically do not have enough fruits, vegetables, whole grains, low-fat dairy foods, those foods that we're all being encouraged to eat more of.
And I suppose you don't really know what's in there. You might get a calorie count these days, but you're not going to get an ingredient list, and so you might not know how many grams of saturated fat are in something, I suppose.
Well, that's an interesting point, and you raised the notion of more nutrition information coming along, and you're absolutely correct. Is a little teeny piece of the Affordable Care Act actually is requiring that chain restaurants that have more than 20 locations serving the same menu, as well as a number of other food venues, including some vending machines, will need by the end of 2015 to make calorie information available. In other words, the calories will be posted on either a menu board or a menu, and then other nutrition information will have to be available to provide upon request.
Do you think that's going to help?
I do think that's going to help. I think that, the information or the research to date on whether nutrition information helps has definitely been equivocal. There are a few studies that show that it has and some studies that show that it hasn't really moved the needle that much in what people order. But I think that with sort of this constant and omnipresent exposure to that information, maybe it will nudge people a little bit in the direction of making some healthier choices.
And along with that information that could nudge people, you've got 10 skills and strategies you think are going to help people eat healthier when they're eating out. What are some of those?
So some of the 10 skills and strategies that I talk about in Eat Out, Eat Well, I'd say the top ones really focus on portion control. I think that we're all aware that one of the big pitfalls of restaurant meals is how much food we're served. So I spend a lot of time in Eat Out, Eat Well, generally giving people strategies about how to get less food put in front of you. And I give these skills also related to 15 different types of cuisine. So I cover about every ethnic cuisine that we frequently see restaurants serving, as well as about 7 different types of American fare. So portion control, I think, is really very much the number one skill. And then another very important skill is figuring out how to eat less fat in restaurants. So whether it's looking at what you're choosing off a menu, as well as the amount of that food that you end up eating, trying to address things like salad dressing, where you always order it on the side, and perhaps you order a bottle of vinegar with that so you can dilute out the dressing that you prefer to eat. You know, it's okay to have that blue cheese or Thousand Island dressing as long as you don't eat tablespoon after tablespoon, and you can still have that taste that you really enjoy if you can just use a few squeezes of lemon or a few drizzles of vinegar. So really, portion control, controlling fats, I think are really the two top skills and strategies for restaurant eating.
So just to zoom in on ethnic cuisine, are there certain types of cuisine that just lend themselves better to healthier eating?
That's a really good question. And one of my premises in the book and really all the work that I do around healthy restaurant eating, coaching people in that direction, is to say that people can choose, and I underline the word choose, to eat healthier in roughly about 95% of restaurants. So while we might think, oh, Mexican cuisine or, you know, Italian cuisine or pizza is, you know, ooh, that's going to be unhealthy and Asian fare is going to be healthier, really not the case. One can choose to eat in any of those types of ethnic restaurants or cuisine and choose to eat healthier or choose to eat unhealthy. I mean, you know, we can go into a Chinese restaurant and we can start with fried egg rolls and we can have sweet and sour pork or shrimp and we can have fried rice and we can end that meal with fried bananas. You know, that's not exactly healthy. Or we can, you know, go into an Italian restaurant, start a meal with a salad and maybe split with our dining partner a portion of pasta with white clam sauce and end up with a bowl of berries and maybe a little whipped cream and have a reasonably healthy meal.
Yeah, that doesn't sound too bad. Well, let's take one that sounds a little more challenging. What about, you know, it's Friday night and you want to go out for a burger and maybe some fries, because what's a burger without fries? So how can you make that healthy if that's what you're really craving?
If that's what you're really craving, then what I think you need to do is look at perhaps the toppings on that burger. You know, if you typically get a bacon cheddar burger, and instead of getting the bacon and the cheese, you can get some more veggies. You can do a slice of onion. You can do some tomato. You can do some lettuce. Maybe you can get some guacamole on that burger. I mean, these days, a lot of restaurants have a number of different toppings, maybe some sauteed onions and mushrooms. So go for some different toppings. I mean, ideally, if it's a sort of a half-pound burger, I would encourage people to consider going splitsies on that, and you have your burger, you have enough fries, and perhaps your dining partner would order a healthy entree salad, and you can split that up as well. So I think in Eat Out, Eat Well, I talk a lot about using menu creativity and outsmarting the menu so you work your way around these huge portions. I mean, what research shows is that the more food that people get sat in front of them, the more they're going to eat. It's just...
We're talking right now about ways to stay healthy while eating out, and we'd like to hear from you on this. Are you someone who does eat out a lot, and do you have strategies that help you stay healthy to make good choices? Maybe you have those treats once in a while, but you figured out ways to make good choices that keep you on track. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can respond on our Central Time Facebook post on that subject. We're talking about ways to eat at restaurants and still be healthy, to make good, healthy choices. And we want you to be part of that conversation. If you eat out a lot, do you have strategies that you use, particular ways of kind of gaming the menu, picking things that allow you to eat healthily and still enjoy that meal out? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. And we are still with Hope Warshaw. She's the author of Eat Out, Eat Well. And Hope, you talked about beating the menu when you go out. What do you mean by that?
I think I said outsmarting a menu.
Outsmarting.
Is that what you meant?
Yeah.
And, right. And then really practicing what I call menu creativity. So not thinking that, you know, you're in a restaurant, so therefore, you know, particularly a sit-down restaurant, that you have to order an entree. That you can look at the menu and say, you know, can I put together a more reasonably sized meal by ordering an appetizer and ordering a salad and maybe saving room to split a dessert and, you know, just sort of mixing and matching and being creative.
Another tool that we have now, which can be a big help, is websites. Does it help, do you think, to scope out the menu ahead of time so you can do some pre-planning?
I think so. And actually, along with Eat Out, Eat Well, soon, hopefully by about the end of the month, there will be a related app, and it will be called Eat Out Well, so people can look for it on iTunes or Google Play. And where the book has roughly about 700 foods listed, as you know, they're divided between healthier bets, which are some healthier foods from these 15 different cuisines, as well as health busters. And the reason I put the health busters in there was because I think it really does educate people to have sort of this oh my God factor reaction to them looking at what the nutrients are, particularly calories and fat in certain menu items. The split in terms of what is available from a nutrition information stance is today there is a lot of information for menu items from what I call in the book a walk-up and order type of restaurant. So where you go in, you stand in line, you look at a menu board, you order, and there's a lot of nutrition information really across the board. No longer is it just burger chains. I've been writing about this topic for over about 20 years, and when I first started out, I mean, we didn't have websites, and I can remember, you know, I was writing to national headquarters of restaurants to try to get information. So relatively speaking, we have a ton of information today. Where, sort of on the flip side, where there really isn't very much information at all is from your sort of small one single standing type of restaurant, like an Indian restaurant or Middle Eastern restaurant, where you know, they're making food mainly from scratch and they only have that one restaurant. I would say the same is true for some of your upscale fine dining restaurants. I mean, you're not going to find nutrition information for those kind of restaurants. But I do think people can use the existing nutrition information that they do have at their fingertips to really educate themselves about the nutrients that are in food. They're not going to be exacting, but a good example is pizza. I mean, we all eat pizza in America. And even if you go to your favorite neighborhood pizza spot, you can look at some of the national chains and the nutrition information and make a reasonable extrapolation to what you're eating.
What if you're out with your family, there are children involved, and maybe you want a healthy meal that's still a little fun for the kids? What are one or two concrete things that a family can do?
Well, I actually have a whole chapter in Eat Out, Eat Well about healthy eating with your kids. And then in each of these 15 cuisine chapters, I have some tips and tactics for parents about eating that particular cuisine. I think it's incredibly important that parents actually train kids from a very early age about ordering healthfully in restaurants and about eating healthfully in restaurants. I think that parents should actually not get their kids into thinking that when they go into a restaurant they order off a kid's menu, or, you know, they're presented with the kid's menu, because generally speaking, that's a really very much a palate-narrowing kind of menu for kids. And I think that we can really use restaurant meals, particularly ethnic restaurants, to expose our kids' palates to a wide variety of foods. I would very much recommend that the same sort of splitting and sharing that I've been talking about, to really, really use family-style ordering in restaurants, whether that is sort of your typical American restaurant where the expectation is that everyone order an entree, or it's the Asian restaurant where it is easier to eat family style because that's sort of how they serve.
And we want to expose kids to things that are healthier. Are there any particular traditions in the food world that you want people to turn to first? Let's say if a kid is used to just ordering off that children's menu, your grilled cheese, your chicken fingers, is there an easy way to start?
To start moving them away from the kids' menu?
Right.
Is that where you're... I think it really depends to an extent on the child. I mean, certainly there's a range of kids and their eating styles and really their range of pickiness. What I might try is to try a favorite ethnic cuisine of that child and to go in and to basically put it out there before you even get to the restaurant and say, we're not going to get the kids' menu tonight. Let's just try as a family to order off the regular menu.
Well, Hope, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. Delighted to be here.
We've been speaking with Hope Warshaw. She's the author of Eat Out, Eat Well. It's time for Wisconsin Life right now. Every year, racers from around the world descend on Eagle River for the World Championship Snowmobile Derby. Emily Bright takes a look at the competition and camaraderie behind the scenes.
Trailers the size of semis line the frozen field around the derby track the evening before the 52nd annual Classic Vintage Snowmobile Derby. Here and there you see someone hunched over a snowmobile making adjustments. To talk to a racer, I'm told, just step inside a trailer. I hesitate, unable to see what's inside. Half a dozen men from southwest Michigan crack jokes in the space not taken up by the 400-pound sled. A crock pot bubbles in the corner. It's such a cozy oasis from the cold, you almost forget why they're here. Any member of a registered racing group can sign up to race at the Derby, but to be competitive in Eagle River takes serious work. Roger Britt's preparations for the super senior class race sound like something out of Field of Dreams.
I ride my trail sled out in the soybean field. We finally got some snow, and I made myself a track where I could go out and get up to speed and get the brain working good, hopefully.
Fellow racer Aaron Giles says he spends most of his evenings working on his snowmobile with the help from his 8-year-old daughter.
She really enjoys working out in the garage, so she's out there a lot with me.
Over and over, you hear how competitive racing runs in families. Chris Sweeten and his brother drove 3 days up from Utah to race in Wisconsin.
Just kind of been on our bucket list. It's kind of hard on the road, but every hotel we've stayed in made sure had a gym and a swimming pool so that I could work out.
Often racers team up, sharing sleds, a pit crew, and sponsors. Russ Davis, vice president of sales and marketing for the Derby, remembers when the race began in the 60s as a loop on a nearby lake. Even now in world championship status, Davis says,
it's a hobby. Here the guys can still think they're driving in Indianapolis and going around fast and very competitive. And you'll see the trophies out there. I mean, they're beautiful trophies, and they win a little prize money.
One trailer from Quebec, Canada looks very competitive, covered with sponsor names and a life-size picture of 18-year-old Sabrina Blanchet, her hair streaming down the back of her blue and orange gear. In real life, she's petite, but she's the only girl who competes for the world championship class. There really aren't many girls in this sport, mostly guys, she says. And that's why I like it. It's more of a challenge. That's what's fun, she says.
You know, we're very excited to see her as a female in a very competitive all-male field.
That's Alan Decker, a career racer whose family owns the Derby track. Decker helps Blanchet when she races in Wisconsin.
This is a very physical sport. It takes a lot of strength to turn them because they turn on carbides on ice, so it's remarkable.
Our interview is cut short as a crank lifts the sled and delivers it outside. Time to give the oval track one more test drive. There's some trouble getting it going. Decker yanks the cord like he's starting a lawnmower. The cold bites through everything, and I'm glad, and a little jealous, to see the racers are well padded, without an inch of skin exposed. They have to be, when they're coming around the turn near 100 miles an hour. At last, Blanchet motors up along the other engines for her last hot lap. No matter who came with you on the journey, once you enter the track, it's just you and your sled against fierce competition on the ice.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Snowmobiling has long been a favorite pastime for Wisconsinites, so it may not come as a surprise to hear that the early versions of snowmobiles were developed right here in Wisconsin.
Carl Eleson patented the modern single-track snowmobile in 1927 in Saner, Wisconsin. And joining us now to talk about their family's legacy is his granddaughter, Jonna Eleson. Jonna, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, can you talk a little bit about your grandfather's role in the origin and development of what we know of today as the modern snowmobile?
Well, he was born in 1899, and unfortunately he had a club foot. And that made it very difficult for him to go hunting and fishing and skiing and doing anything that the normal guys did. So pretty much all of his life, he was a little bit behind. And he always thought about devising some way that he could keep up. And he tried, one of his early trials was a Model T with tracks on it, like so many other people did. And it didn't turn out for what he wanted it to. He wants a small snowmobile with that floats over the snow and that can maneuver between trees and get out where he needs to get. So in 1924, he bought a general store here in Saner, and he began working on what he calls the motor toboggan. And I'm standing here in our museum right now looking at it, and it's really something to look at, because what he did was he took wood snow skis and he fashioned them into a toboggan, and he made a belly pan in the front. And to this, he mounted a 2.5-horse Johnson outboard motor engine with a shortened shaft on it, of course. And to that shaft, he put a bicycle sprocket, and then he went to what they call a jack shaft, and he put another bicycle sprocket on there. And from there, he drove the track, and it was a single endless track. And that was kind of a first. In fact, it was the first designed for snow, and it was the first machine that was actually designed specifically for snow. And it was, he could steer it. He put two other skis underneath, and he could steer it with ropes.
Now, Johnny, you're looking at that original motor toboggan now. If somebody came in from the 21st century with a vision of a snowmobile in their head, would they look at this and say, oh yeah, that's a snowmobile, or does it look radically different than what we know today?
Well, I'm so used to looking at it that it's hard for me to say. But from the reaction that we have with people coming in, they look at it and they're just absolutely flabbergasted. When they see the innovation that went into making this thing, and actually how many things on here that were the first in 1924 and are still used today. Like, the first machine was a liquid-cooled engine. He uses a slide rail suspension, and it's a single track, and it's about 100 inches long, which is a little over 8 feet, and it's 2 feet wide, and it weighs about 150, 200 pounds. And that was his first version of it, and everybody thought he was nuts when he was building it. You know, they thought he was crazy. They never saw anything like it. But as soon as he put it out on the snow and it was successful, that's when he decided he had to patent it, because everybody wanted one. All of his friends wanted one then, because now all of a sudden he's the first one to the hunting grounds and to the trap line, and so it worked out really well for him.
Right, so back then when snowmobiles first hit, what were people using them for? Now you see them for a lot of recreation, but originally how were people using snowmobiles?
Well, they were using them for anything that they could do in the wintertime, usually work. And some of the utilities used them for checking lines, and a lot of trappers and hunters and fishermen used them, because there was nothing up here to do in the wintertime. You had to eat off the land. So, you know, that got them out. It got them through their trap line a lot faster, and it got them out, you know, into the woods to go hunting. And they could carry, you know, an animal back or whatever they needed to do. But that was pretty much up until the 1960s, that was pretty much, you know, what they were used for was either the military or work applications.
Now, these are, as you described, this is a pretty big snowmobile. What was it like to ride around on one of these massive early models?
They're really not that big, Rob. They're very comparable in size and weight to the snowmobiles we use today.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They look big because you probably saw some photographs with four guys on them.
I did. That's why I thought they were so big.
Yeah, that was probably a pretty good photo op. They could haul four people, three people, and they did. But usually it was one or two people that would go out on them. And, of course, I never got to ride one of those early toboggan models because I was born in 1962. But on his last model that he designed, his K-12, is the model that I grew up riding since I was a baby until I was like 9 years old when I got a Polaris Playmate.
So if someone wants to see one of these early snowmobiles, are they still around for people to go see?
Well, we actually, Saner, Wisconsin has the best variety of Ulyson snowmobiles probably anywhere in the world. And in the wintertime, we have five of them here on display, including the first one at our lumber and hardware store, Ulyson Lumber and Hardware. And we're right downtown Saner. And we have a nice museum with windows facing out, so even if we're not open, people can come by and see our display. But in the summertime, we send the first snowmobile down to the Vilas County Historical Society Museum, which is just down the road about a block. And down there, they have one of every machine that my grandpa's designs with Four Wheel Drive Corporation, which was the one who had to produce these in mass quantities. So, along with a bunch of other manufacturers. So it's an excellent museum for anybody to visit, but that's only open in the summer.
Jonna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Jonna Ulyson, granddaughter of Carl Ulyson, inventor of the single-track snowmobile.